There was a time in this country, not too long ago, when raw animal hides were transformed into leather. The skins of cows, sheep and even goats were sold by the meat factories to local tanneries where the labour-intensive job of turning skin into leather took place. But not anymore. Leather is no longer made in Ireland because all the tanneries have closed down. Like so much in manufacturing, tanning has moved eastwards to China, where it can be done for less money. In her continuing look at goods that are made in Ireland, Ellen McSweeney joins me this morning to take a look at Ireland's last tannery and the future for leatherwork in this country. Ella, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, briefly about tanning, first recorded, 5,000 years ago, when the Sumerians used flour, water, beer and wine. What exactly does all of that do to an animal skin?
It kills it. And of course, everyone knows, people who eat hairy bacon know you can eat the skin. It's a live piece of flesh. So what you need to do is you need to kill it. But you also need to make sure that it's stable, it won't shrink, and when it gets wet, get all plump again as well. So the tanning is a process that turns the proteins in the skin, deadens them and stabilises them as well. And the Sumerians were onto something using beer and wine, because what they were after was the tannin, which is found, of course, in vines. It's found in hop plants and it's also found in oak. In Ireland, raw oak bark would have been used in the ancient process of tanning. And I read this book, an 1812 book, An Account of Ireland, Statistical and Political. And at that time, oak, of course, was being cut down. And the man said, the want of oak bark in Ireland is a great impediment to tanning. So you can see there was always this connection with oak. But that's the fundamental thing. Now, of course, they use synthetic material.
But hugely impressive levels of production during the peak of tanneries in the 1960s. There was 40 million square feet of leather produced every year. 40 million. And 80% of that went for export. 1,500 people were employed. It was a huge industry.
And the model that, of course, you want, which is lots of employment and then, you know, export as well. And there's no doubt it was productive. And we were a farming nation. We still are. There's a whole load of animal skins going for want. So the problem is there were few environmental concerns back then. And the environmental issue with tanning is it is absolutely filthy. Back to the 13th century, people were talking about how dirty tanning was. The story of Portlaw is one that your listeners will probably know in Waterford. It was pretty devastating. It opened in 1935 on the site of the old cotton factory, which devastated the town at the time. Portlaw Tannery opened in 1935. By 1985, the Irish government had plugged 9 million old Irish pounds into it to keep it afloat and keep the 380 people employed. And it closed in 1985. And it really was the rise of popularity in synthetic materials like rubber, but also the competition from places like China and South America as well.
Now, Portlaw, though, it wasn't the last tannery to close in Ireland. That was actually Ronan Leathers in Clonmel. And you went there to see what was left.
I do, because most people imagine that it was Portlaw, but it's actually a small tannery in Clonmel. It's called Ronan Leathers, set up by Paul Ronan's father in the 1960s. He worked in meat factories. He was salting the hides, exporting them, and realised we could make lots of added value here. There's 100% added value to be made from a raw animal skin to leather. So he set up this incredible tannery. And these are old buildings. They still exist just behind where Paul Ronan, the gentleman, the son, I went to meet him. He doesn't go into them that much, and that's not surprising. He got the keys and we walked into the old tannery and he took me up the steps to show me the old building.
This is where we actually did the de-wooling of the sheepskins and the drying of the wool.
What a sight. This is an enormous space here, completely derelict. The lights are hanging from the ceiling, not on. And through this door, so this is an old machine.
This is the remnants of an old wool dryer. Because again, if you leave wool in its wet condition, it actually heats and eventually can go on fire.
It's rusted machinery covered in sort of cobwebs and all the rest. Behind us is an old Belfast sink. Presumably this is where people wash their hands all
the workers.
Yeah. And here is a little small room.
That's where wool would have been blown up from a process downstairs, and it would actually been blown up through tubes.
And Paul, there's always a slightly strange feeling when you go into derelict buildings that you can imagine in your mind the activity, and there are obviously so many reminders here with the equipment rusting. Is it too romantic to look at this and feel sad about it? Or do you look at this and feel, what a relief, I'm not involved in that anymore?
It is a bit of a relief that I'm not involved in it, because, you know, when you see a business that you're fighting against a force that you just cannot win against, it is almost a relief once we'd actually made the decision. And I remember arriving in at the beginning of that January, I said, no, look, let's be pragmatic about this. And really from there on, we set about the unwinding process.
Was it that you were being put under pressure for price, or were you just losing business full stop?
Cattle hide or sheepskin price, it's a world commodity. So you're paying world prices. We were having to look for more money for our finished product, and that money wasn't there.
And that's really about labour costs.
And that's about labour costs and environmental costs.
So, Ella, how many people worked there?
There were, at its height, 185 people employed there. It had a turnover of 35 million at its peak as well. And as I said before, there is substantial money to be made here. It's 100% added value. I did speak, I mean, and obviously these are 185, it's a business decision to close it, but these were 185 families who were affected at the time. There was actually a sit-in for a few months. The staff were so furious, but they understood the reality of this globalised product. And I spoke to an older gentleman, a lovely guy called Jim Cleary, and he worked at Paul's Tannery for 40 years, and he spoke to me a little bit about the work.
I was just helping around locally around the factory here, doing anything that I had to do, looking after the quality of the leather and things like that. Very heavy work. Lifting hides, big heavy hides, at that time they had to be carried by hand, but carrying by hand was very hard.
And in this space there's pigeon poo on the floor, there are lights hanging, it's dark, it's a huge space that's empty. How many people would have been in this room working?
About 12. That door over there now, all the sheepskins just come up there, and there was a special paint put on them, and they'd leave them overnight, and then the wool would be to take off.
Did you like the work?
I didn't at the time. It was hard work. It was often I came in here at 6 o'clock in the morning and I'd finish at 10 at night time.
Do you miss it?
Actually, I did. You were leaving your home, it looked like that, you know. I mean, after 40 years, you just feel, this is my life finished here now. Not having anything to get up to in the morning, it's very hard.
So the question, Ella, is tanning finished forever in Ireland? I mean, is there any case, given the amounts of hides that we produce, for keeping it at home and adding the value here?
From the people I have spoken to, absolutely not. And the environmental cost is substantial. It is, as I said, a filthy business. And really, the economics of this is that it makes more sense to mass produce it in places where labour costs are cheaper and the environmental sort of controls aren't so stringent. And that's a sad reflection, I suppose, on how globalised products work.
At the same time, there is still a tanning industry in Europe, isn't there?
There is. I mean, I asked Paul, is there much of a future in Ireland? He said, absolutely not in Ireland. And he doesn't think either that there's much of a future in Europe. I mean, in 2006, there was something like 52,000 people employed within the whole of Europe. It was worth 10 billion euro. And most crucially, it was basically from family-owned regional companies. And that really shows the kind of pattern that it was in Ireland as well, where the impact is really felt strongly. But, you know, maybe when the true environmental costs are factored into the products that we buy, there will be a rebalancing. But as long as China can manufacture these things en masse and not have such controls...
And we're not asking questions about what they're doing to their environment or how little they are paying their workers. So, Paul, these days, he's exporting raw skins, is that
Paul
right?
is doing what his father did before he set up the tannery. If you add a bit of salt to raw animal skin, you give it a couple of weeks extra life.
Okay.
That's what his father did before he set up the tannery. Paul has gone back to that. He now just salts the skins and exports them to China and all the rest.
And then they get processed there and turned into fine leather. And then we bring them back in.
Brought back in.
So who's working with, shall we say, raw leather rather than raw hide in Ireland?
It's a bit of more of a positive story, although it still has gone down. Saddle makers are doing it, artists are doing it, artisan craftspeople are doing it, and shoemakers. And I think your listeners definitely will remember shoemakers in Ireland, the likes of Governey's Boot and Shoe Shop in Carlow, which set up in the 1930s. At its height, it was making 3,500 pairs of shoes a week, which is extraordinary. And it had this little ditty, north, south, east, west, Governey's shoes are the best. There was also the Reliable Shoe Company in Newport. George Tutty is someone, those shoe factories, of course, have gone. George Tutty has a shop in Naas that his father set up in 1941. He imports raw leather, mm-hmm. sheets of leather, and he hand makes shoes in this shop. And it's a lovely old shop. It's got an old 1940s window full of all the old equipment and the tools. You go in and it's like a little, you know, a manufacturing hub of people hammering, people sewing. So I went in, I met George Jr., and he showed me his cabinet full of coloured leather and just explained to me where it all came from.
We'll go upstairs to the upper department. This is where we make the uppers. We select the letters and make the uppers and sew them for the bottoms room.
So lots of sewing machines in here. Hello, how are you?
Evie's our machinist. She sews the uppers and Christoph cuts the patterns from the hides.
George, if you wouldn't mind, just tell me a little bit about the animals. We have an array of incredible different coloured leathers here. Where do they all come from?
Okay, well, these calfskins up here, we use those generally for gent's weight shoe, and the skins are coming from either France or England. These skins here, they're pigskins. Now, we mainly use pigskins in the lining of the shoe. The pigskin is manufactured in Japan. You have goatskins. There's quite a selection of colours in the goat, and we like to use the goatskins for ladies' shoes. It's kid goat, of course.
And so you've mentioned these three animals, the goat, the cow and the pig. They all came from abroad. You're importing all this leather in. Is there a chance that those animals grazed on Irish grass or were farmed in Ireland and were exported and then the leather is brought back in again?
Very likely. It's quite possible. There's no track and trace with hides as such. All we know is where it was actually cured, but where the animal came from. Quite likely it could be an Irish hide.
That's very interesting, Ella, because there's something about Irish farming that makes our leather particularly good. What is
because
that?
Because it's so Irish farming is so fantastic, of course. But we also, because we switched over very well from barbed wire to electric fencing and wooden fencing, we have a very good reputation internationally for hides, and there's a lot of demand for Irish hides.
So you don't have scarred hides from the barbed wire?
If you talk to people who work in leather or in tanneries about barbed wire, they just start shivering with disgust. Mm. So.
And the other thing too, there is a religious dimension to this, because some people will not wear the hides of some animals.
Yeah, of course. I mean, Hindus won't wear cow leather. Muslims won't wear pig skin, and of course Jains and vegetarians and vegans won't wear any leather. And vegetarians who are wearing leather, beware, it is an intrinsic part of the meat trade. So if you think you can separate out, you can't.
I remember recommending on this programme years and years ago that you've tried to find the sick animals and make leather shoes for people who know that they died a natural death rather than
But you have what they call religiously neutral leathers from deer and ostrich, and there has been a worldwide increased demand for these leathers.
Now, George Tutty, it's a family affair?
It is, and happily so. His nephew, George Marin, showed me how he was making a riding boot downstairs with a hammer and nail. And I just watched him work, and he explained to me what he was doing.
We're stretching the leather around the shape of the foot. It's a slow process, but it's a process that probably hasn't changed in a couple of hundred years. But it's the best way of doing it.
Why?
Well, because you're getting the handcrafted shoe and the attention to detail, which isn't there on a mass-produced scale at all. So I'm just putting a few tacks in to hold the leather in place. You pull, stretch, tack, and you repeat that operation a number of times.
And this is a riding boot. What kind of leather is that?
It's calf leather. With a riding boot, they're jumping through hedges and all that sort of stuff. It needs to be very strong, very durable, and waterproof to a certain degree. And you continue the operation all around the sole of the shoe until everything is stretched and tight.
Do you find it very satisfying to be working with your hands so much?
Yeah. I came from an industry that was completely automated, robotics and everything, and coming back to working with my hands, it's a nice change. You're putting yourself into the product, and it's nice to see a good job at the end of the day, you know. That's it.
Now, Ella, clearly the labour costs are high, so what future does a handmade industry like this have in a recession?
It's all driven by us and what we're prepared to pay for products, shoes and all the rest. So that's where the driver is, of course.
But they're not going for the mass market.
I think that, you know, George, I mean, particularly is going for the market where people have difficult feet. So they might have bunions or they might have one foot bigger than the other or whatever. And also the riding industry, the jockey industry. He makes riding boots for jockeys that weigh apparently in the ounces. So, you know, it's a specialised business. George's shoes cost about €450 each. Which I think is actually a bargain, having seen the whole process. It's kind of remarkable. But George, I asked him about the future for made in Ireland, you know, shoes, and he's kind of sad about what's happened.
Well, in the past, it would appear that we just accepted that we were part of Europe now and we should work as we're told. And we gave up some homespun industries too easily. And I think people could look around today and look at industry that's maybe could be rejuvenated. There's a huge interest in handmade items. And there's a lot of skilled people. They just need to have faith in themselves.
Yeah, see, in an era of mass everything, every T-shirt is the same, every pair of trousers is the same, every pair of shoes is made by the gazillion in China. You know, there are people who want something that's a little bit unique and which will last forever.
A little bit unique. I mean, his shoes certainly last. There's no doubt about that. But also, I suppose we don't know the full story of the goods that we're getting from other countries, really. We don't know what the true costs are. The one thing is for certain, where something is cheap, there are costs. It's just that we mightn't be bearing them.
All right, Ella, thank you very much for joining us. Made in Ireland is an Athena Media production supported by the BAI Sound and Vision Scheme. And Ella's with us on Mondays or Tuesdays with more Made in Ireland stories. And share yours on Facebook and our website, rte.ie, where you'll find extra audio, photographs and videos every week. Ella, thank you.
Thank you, Pat.